Is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 8th, 2026. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University, author of The Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered Our Economy and Threatened Our Future Prosperity. Did I say February 9th? 8th? Well, it's the 9th. Also on the program on February 9th, Senate returns today facing a DHS shutdown on Friday. Unclear if ICE would go unfunded because they have a huge slush fund. Meanwhile, Ghislaine Maxwell pleads the fifth in a closed-door deposition with Congress. New York City nurses make a deal to end its strike at two hospitals in New York City. One is extant. More reports of torturous conditions in ICE concentration camps. Meanwhile, the conservative Fifth Circuit of Appeals rules against due process for detained migrants. That applies only in the Fifth Circuit, Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma. Trump pushing for the Nexstar-Tegna merger. Dr. Oz urges Americans to get measles vaccine as cases increase, particularly among young kids.
Huh.
I didn't authorize that.
Okay, Fauci.
Netanyahu moves up his meeting with Trump in fear of U.S.-Iranian negotiations. U.S. government to fund MAGA-aligned think tanks and charities across Europe. Think USAID without the AID. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is
Fun day Monday.
Lots to get to today. We don't need to discuss sport games or anything like that that took place yesterday. We don't have time for it, so we won't.
Your team loses, you turn into an obnoxious sports ball guy.
I just think that, like, we don't have time for it.
Oh, we can talk about the Bills. Celtics.
No, we're not talking about sports. I mean, of course, we'll be talking about the halftime show, which everybody's talking about. Of course, I'm talking about the performance of who's the other guy besides Kid Rock who performed?
I like the cellist in the pirate costume.
The country.
They're all named like Brantley Gilbert and
yeah, right.
Gilbert
Brayley.
Branchy. I don't know.
They're all like men, but somehow named what the most racist white lady you went to high school with named her first child. So
it's going to be fun to see, you know, after a couple of days when Milo Yiannopoulos figures out how the TPUSA people fake their viewership.
Oh, yeah.
We'll keep eyes out on that.
That was like the Pablo Torre of the right.
But I know.
It does look like, however, that however many people actually watched that thing saw Kid Rock get bored with lip syncing like halfway through his song, apparently, and decide that I don't need to actually put the microphone to my mouth. I'm doing this telepathically.
I will dance in jean shirts and my fedora.
For the kids, for TPUSA to reach out to college kids. I mean, kids in the his name, so this must be what all the children are
into. His old man Rock.
Hello, fellow youngsters.
He's just eye candy anyway. Oh. He needs to hear him sing.
All right, well, listen, let's get into this. Last week, I think, I can't remember if it was during the show or it was overnight, Donald Trump had posted there's really no other way to describe it other than like an incredibly racist meme of the Obamas on the heads of apes. And, you know, we were talking that this was sort of like another Rob Reiner moment for Trump, where he took away the ability of his supporters to pretend like they're not racist. Like this is...
Or just bad people. I mean, the Reiner thing was, I think...
Right.
You know, they not that that was racist in the comments that he made. They were just sociopathic, horrific, and cruel.
Right. And this, you know, one of the sort of like unspoken words, or I should say agreements between... Really, in many respects, Republican voters, not all Republican voters, but the vast majority, and their politicians is, we got to speak in enough coded language that you're acknowledging that we don't like black and brown people, but not in such a way that it seems obvious or ridiculously obvious that we don't like black and brown people. And so... that's why it's so important to have figures like Tim Scott and other, you know, and Clarence Thomas and
Ben Carson.
Ben Carson.
And the guys behind me who have the shirt called Black for Trump.
Black for Trump.
Where's my black guy?
Yeah.
Where's my black guy? Those people function as essentially provide license for white people to be bigoted because they're... If this was a bigoted movement, Tim Scott wouldn't be a Republican. And that's basically it. And Trump sort of broke that agreement in doing this and made it very difficult for people. This is not, you don't do this in public. And here is Trump. We should say there's stories. When it first came out, Caroline Leavitt defended it by saying people being overly sensitive, that it wasn't racist. That was the first story. And then she said it was fake outrage, telling news outlets that it was from an internet meme video depicting President Trump as the king of jungle and Democrats and characters from The Lion King. Those characters weren't in The Lion King.
No gorillas in The Lion
King. It's just a Lion King joke.
It's a Lion King joke.
You can't make fun of anything.
And then they ended up deleting the tweet because they realized, like, oh, wait a second,
that guy got mad at us.
And just to be clear, Donald Trump obviously tweeted this. Truth. And they are going to blame a fictional person. Like, there were times on this program, I'm not speaking out of time, where I would blame, what was the name of the person I would blame?
Oh God! It wasn't.
A fictional producer.
Wasn't Brendan? But
yeah, what was the fake name you had for Brendan?
I can't remember what it is now. It wasn't Brian.
Dang.
Yeah, Patrick.
Patrick.
Yes, I would blame Patrick when we had something go wrong here, or if I had done something that was in a, you know, I'd sent an email, I would just, it's Patrick's fault. And Patrick got fired many, many times on this program.
And that Jimmy was in Miami Dore, living large.
Did Jimmy Dore steal that tactic? Anyway.
Exactly. And
yeah, I don't know who said that thing about vaccines.
But here is Trump talking about how Patrick... His Patrick really messed up.
The media post that you took down earlier today, the White House says that a staffer sent it. Who sent it, and are you going to fire them?
I looked at it. I saw it, and I just looked at the first part. It was about voter fraud in someplace, Georgia. There was a lot of voter fraud, 2020 voter fraud. And I didn't see the whole thing. I guess during the end of it, there was some kind of a people... don't like. I wouldn't like it either, but I didn't see it. I looked at the first part, and it was really about voter fraud in and the machines, how crooked it is, how disgusting it is. Then I gave it to the people to generally they look at the whole thing, but I guess somebody didn't, and they posted, and we took it down, and we turned it, you know. But that was a voter fraud that nobody talks about. They don't like to talk about that post. We took it down as soon as we found out about it.
Mr. President, a number of Republicans are calling on you to apologize for that post. Is that something you're going to do?
No, I didn't make a mistake. I mean, I look at a lot of thousands of things. I looked at the beginning of it. It was fine. They had that one post, and I guess it was a takeoff. By the way, a lot of people covered. If you look at where it came from, I guess it was a takeoff on The Lion King. And,
yeah,
certainly it was.
Until he said that, I'm like, is he trying to like fudge this by saying he's referring to something else? Because there's nothing about
let's see how deep you have to go into the post to get a sense of whether that thing is a race. Because what he's arguing, it sounds like there was a bunch of voter fraud stuff and then tacked on. Or deep into the thing.
Is a racist dog whistle.
So let's just be fair and let's play it from the beginning and count how many seconds, I'll count while we play this, how many seconds it takes to see that part that he says he never saw because it was at the end of the thing. All right, ready? Begin. One missus.
And I haven't pressed play yet.
Okay.
Okay. Let's try it again. Let's try this again. We get a press play.
Okay.
Ready?
Go. Keep it sound.
One missus. Yeah, okay. We did it. That's Jesus. It.
Do you remember the White House Correspondents' Dinner in, 2014 or whenever it was when Obama put up the what he said was his birth video? He had some good comedy writers that year. And that's when Trump was in the audience. This was when the birther conspiracy was really picking up steam and Trump was at the forefront of that. And Obama said, "This is my birth video," and they played the clip from The Lion King. I just wonder how much that is still embedded in his mind and fixated on it. Now he's tweeting out AI slop that's supposedly associated with The Lion King that has explicitly racist images about Obama right at the beginning.
Well, that wasn't me. It was someone. The people did it.
Right.
I gave it to the people.
I gave it to the people.
But here is an example. I mean, in addition to the fact that you had all these stories about the White House really mad at that person, not Scavino, who looks at his tweets, and not Donald Trump, but the other person. Let's just call him Patrick, because we're never going to name him. And of course, I'm sure that person's been fired, although no one has been fired. But they're very upset about that person. And the reason is because, again, it just becomes too hard for his voters to own it publicly. Not all the voters. I'm sure the vast majority of them are enjoying it. But this is supposed to be something that you trade privately.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
I sent the group email with everybody, or I put this on the...
That's for the group chat.
I grouped this on the group chat. Exactly. Like, without a doubt. If we were to have access to like the TPUSA Slack, this would be all over it.
Yeah.
But we don't. And the problem is you're not supposed to do this in public. And here is an example of why that's a problem for the president and Republicans.
Oh, my word. I am a registered Republican. My dad was the president of American Pipeliners Association, so I came by it rather naturally. Voted for the president, supported him, but I really want to apologize. I mean, I'm looking at this awful picture of the Obamas. What an embarrassment to our country. All this man does is tell lies. He is not worthy of the presidency. He takes bribes blatantly, and now he's being a racist blatantly. They were supposed to deport the dangerous criminals. They were not supposed to go after small children, storm schools, bring terror upon, you know, the little kids and the women and children, not just the immigrants in the school. All the children are scared. This is not a decent man. This is not an honest man. He openly takes bribes. He's pathetic as a president. And I just want to apologize to everybody in the country for supporting this rotten, rotten man.
John, did you vote for him in all three elections?
I did. I was sucked into the stupidity of creating jobs. And there are no more jobs in New Mexico. Things are worse than they were before. You cannot find a primary care physician. Our governor just passed some laws to try to help. If you are a young physician, we want you in New Mexico. Come here. There's a great need for you.
All right.
It would be fascinating to sort of like reverse engineer and find out at what point what of those things he listed pushed him over the edge. In other words, like, we've got Andrew McCarthy from the National Review writing in the first part of a series of the Trump administration, or Trump himself, the bribes that have been going on. And he's said, like, within like the first month, as Andrew McCarthy believed about the Biden administration was times 10 with the Trump administration. And this caller, I don't know if he was worried about like sort of like, and it was all the blatant aspect. He said the word blatant over and over again, like out in public. And I think like it's unclear what straw broke the camel's back, but they have a building sort of concern, and it's not until they're sort of exposed that they complain about it. But we will talk more about this in the program. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University, author of The Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered Our Economy and Threaten Our Future Prosperity, I should say. But first, a couple of words from our sponsors. First today is something that, you know, people don't generally want to talk about, and that is dying.
Oh, gosh.
But unfortunately, it's going to happen to all of us. But you can be prepared. This is the big thing, is that, you cannot obviously prevent dying, but you can prevent dying without your stuff in order. With Trust and Will Online Estate Planning, if you're a parent, if you're a homeowner, if you're a spouse, are you caring for your aging parents? It may be time to think about estate planning. And I can tell you, you don't have to have a massive estate. You can have a 2016 Subaru, but the point being that you want it to not have to go through probate and all this other stuff and make it difficult. If you're a procrastinator, 43% of Americans who say they haven't gotten around to making a will yet, I could tell you that it was hanging over my head for a long time. What seemed like forever after Milo was born. That's when I started to really get I got to do something about this and set this stuff up. Just getting it done was a huge relief. And I went through the process with Trust and Will just to see what was going on. It is super straightforward. You can do it in as little as 30 minutes. If you don't know where to start when it comes to estate planning, if you're overwhelmed by questions you might not know the answer to, well, Trust in Wills online platform provides a step-by-step guided process, offers optional one-on-one support from attorneys in your state. It's super easy. It asks you basic questions. You know, are you married? Are you divorced? Are you single? How many kids do you have? What are their ages? I mean, it's really just walks you through this. Estate planning may sound expensive. If you're not sure if you have enough assets to warrant a will and trust, everything has something to leave behind. Trust and Will believes estate planning should be accessible to everyone, so they're committed to making it affordable today and valuable tomorrow. I can tell you, the whole process, seamless, straightforward. And particularly if you don't have like a super complicated, sets of assets and whatnot, you still want to make it easy for people to get what you want to leave behind when you pass away. But this is really straightforward. Trust and Will products are attorney designed. They are state specific. They're customized to your needs. Trust and Will was created by legal experts designed to grow with you so you can easily update your plan at every life stage or transition. Don't wait until it's too late. Protect your loved ones today, tomorrow, and beyond with Trust and Will, the most trusted name in online estate planning. Go to trustandwill.com/majority to get 20% off. That's trustandwill.com/majority to get your 20% off. trustandwill.com/majority. Also sponsoring the program, basically what got me through the last week with Saul, that is Factor Meals. It's super cold out. Don't want to go to the supermarket. I rarely have time to cook. And frankly, I have noticed over the past 6 weeks at the beginning of the year that by the time I get home, I have to immediately take a nap. I am so overwhelmed. Factor made it super easy for me to make meals for Saul, cook meals for Saul, heat up meals for Saul that are delicious and healthy. Want to thank Factor for supporting the Majority Report. Go to factormeals.com/majority50off. Use the code majority50off to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for a year. Factor meals are full quality, functional ingredients, including lean proteins, colorful veggies, and whole food ingredients and healthy fats. I got this like a chicken thigh with like a mashed potatoes that was fantastic. I actually ended up getting these. I got some tortillas and I made Saul and I had like little I don't know what you call it, but it was super easy to make because, again, I've talked about this before. I never understood why people had microwaves and now I get it. Because you take the food, you heat it up, it takes about 2 minutes. Factor has a 100 rotating weekly meals to keep things fresh and delicious through winter. You can choose high-protein, calorie-smart, Mediterranean diet, GLP-1 support, ready-to-eat salads. They even have a new Muscle Pro collection to support strength and recovery. I don't know what I got it from. I think I just got it from, like, family friendly. I'm not sure. Factor meals are always fresh, never frozen, ready in about 2 minutes. All this stuff doesn't come frozen. It comes fresh. They pack it really nicely with a lot of recyclable materials. You put it in your fridge and there's your whole week of meals. Head to factormeals.com/majority50off. Use the code majority50off to get 50% off and free breakfast for a year. Eat like a pro this month with Factor. New subscribers only, varies by plan. One free breakfast item per box for 1 year while subscription is active. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University and author of Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered Our Economy and Threaten Our Future Prosperity. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome back to the program Professor Tim Wu, a professor of law at Columbia University, author of Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered Our Economy and Threatened Our Future Prosperity. Tim, welcome back to the program. I don't know if it was the last time was like when you ran for lieutenant governor.
It may have been. It may have been.
But I feel like we had you on with for your last book, the Curse of Bigness, I think.
Yeah.
But I can't remember. But this one is another entry into the – and it's a little more specific in terms of antitrust, focusing more on sort of the concept of platforms. And let's start with, like, the idea of platforms. You start the book off by going back into history to explain that the concept of platforms – have been with us since we were able to really sort of communicate via writing and maybe speaking.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book is I'm a believer that platforms, it's a word we use all the time, have been at the core of almost every successful civilization, you know, going back to ancient Greece and so forth. But I think platforms, you know, say a lot about what kind of civilization you have. And one of the reasons people thought ancient Greece was so great is that, you know, you had this kind of place everyone bought and sold and talked and did everything in the center of town, very fair, open to citizens. In our time, the platform, which is, again, this technology space, intermediary that brings together buyers and sellers, speaker and listeners, we in our age, there's the tech platforms that have taken over that role. And essentially, in my view, have taken on an extraordinary amount of power in that role. And that's basically what this book is about.
And we'll get back to that idea of how they mm-hmm. have gone from like the platform and sort of the act on top of that platform, if you will. Yeah. But let's also, like, you recount the sort of the hopes and aspirations when the internet first sort of like got up and running. I am old enough to remember that era and have lived through it. But speak to that idea, because I feel like we had maybe a good half dozen years of like sort of at that peak of where it was going to. Where people could sort of realize and also project into the future of it being some form of democratizing force, I guess.
Yeah, I think one of the questions, or maybe the main question this book asks, is like, what happened to the dream of the 90s? Sort of short form. You know, we had this idea, particularly around the internet, although more broadly and across institutions, that the internet was going to make everybody rich. It was going to make every country on earth a democracy. It was going to give an outlet to sort of every creative force and every kind of potential. Now, some of that has happened in certain ways, but what has happened over the last 12 years, I mean, I think you can kind of have a before and after. There's this turning point in around, I guess, 2012, 2013, just to pin it down, where I think the internet goes from being enabling to being extractive. And all of the major platforms, most of the technologies kind of reach the maturity and begin taking more and more from the economy for themselves. So this, you know, instrument, this technology, which was designed to make everybody rich and make everybody heard, really becomes something quite different over the last 12 years. And that's the trend I think we need to change.
What was it around at that time that marks it for you? I mean, like, it almost like in the beginning we had like we had CompuServe and AOL, and they were sort of like the you were in a fixed world at the very beginning, just because I think people didn't understand how to operate this. But then people got more savvy in the late 90s and into the aughts, and we're able to sort of like swim you know, areas where there wasn't buoys, you know, sort of like, you know, where there was no lifeguard essentially for you. But what was it that changed to mark that? Like, why do you mark 2010 and 2012? What actually happened then?
You know, I would basically use a single word, monopoly. I think that's the period where the main tech platforms sort of established and entrenched and fortified their monopoly and realized that what they wanted to do was to defend their position and begin turning up the dials of extraction. And, you know, it didn't happen all in one day. You know, it's a little bit like the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. But it's that decade, that especially that period where you had a lot of the warning signs. I mean, let me go across platforms. In 2010, 2012, Amazon was still an amazing place for independent small businesses to make money at that period. The take from Amazon was like 20%. You know, now you zoom forward here into our era, and they've moved it up into the 50s, 60s. It's very hard for a small business to make any money. Their take is huge. They have an advertising fee, which is basically paying for, you know, search results when you look for stuff on Amazon, that earned $56 billion in 2024. This year, it's over $70 billion. So, I mean, you could fund, I don't know how many media outlets or whatever you want with $70 billion of pure and adulterated profit for something that makes the product worse. Google flipping around then started buying its competitors. They bought Waze. That's something I talk about in the book. So we lose competition in this area. They start jacking up the advertising. Facebook buys off its main competitors, Instagram and WhatsApp. And everything just kind of congeals during that era. And they turn on the extraction algorithm, basically. And, you know, my friend Corey uses a, are you allowed to use bad words on this show?
Yes.
All right. That's when the enshittification begins.
Yeah.
Right.
And I link it very closely to establish a monopoly and all about defense. And so this beautiful thing, which was supposed to make everybody able to do everything and make a lot of money and so forth, turns into the opposite, starts running in the opposite direction.
Where were the antitrust cops on the beat at this time period? I mean, specifically, I guess I want to point to the Obama administration.
Yeah, I would say in hibernation. Now, I was part of that administration, and I saw it firsthand, but, like, just take the Waze Google takeover. So, you know, Google bought Waze. Those were the only two mapping programs that were significant at the time. Anyone who knows anything about monopoly has heard of antitrust, knows about merger. You're not to be able to also buy your most dangerous competitor, right? Two companies to one, the only two companies, it's, like, obvious. So one day, it was an antitrust party. I asked, I found the staffer, and I was like, what was going on with that? Because I didn't work on it. She said, oh, you know, the boss had this idea that Google is where you go when you want to know where you are. Waze is where you go if you want to know where you're going. So they decided they weren't really competitors. They could let the merger go forward. I mean, there was a deep and, I think, really wrongful, dangerous and belief in two principles during that time. One was, you know, kind of this neoliberal idea the market could always solve things. So, oh, don't worry about it. There'll be someone else. Even though Google bought Waze, something else new will come along. Well, nothing new came along. And the other was this idea, well, tech is always special, so we can never touch them. And look, I was in the Obama administration. We thought of Google as kind of like a charity, and we were really nice to them, but we, like, were not thinking straight about the dangers of private power.
I, you know, it's funny, but you mentioned Google because before we took this show as a podcast, I did a series of short videos, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but I know I did one about Google, and this is like 2010, maybe, reminding them of their slogan, which when they launched, people forget this, is don't be evil. And yeah. There was a sense of like they're, oh, wow, they have a real attitude about going into this industry. And then it just sort of melted away.
You know, I have the line in my book where I feel like over time, structure beats out good intentions. And the thing with Google is they structured, they were a very well-meaning company. I think they were a progressive force. They were important. But they didn't structure anything to protect themselves to stay that way. You know, unlike Wikipedia, which made itself into a nonprofit, Google just said, okay, we'll be a regular for-profit combination, but we're really good guys and we will be different. And like, we're never going to do anything bad and don't be evil. And, you know, after 10 years, everybody, and you needing to make money and investors staring you down, you know, the strongest will gets collapsed. No one can obey two masters, and they, you know, eventually their good intentions faded.
All right. Well, let's go back. I want to talk about the notion of hurting. As I mean, that you write about, like, this is much of this. I mean, I think, like, there are elements both on both ends where without structure, you know, water will drop to the lowest point, and sort of our tendencies will just, even as citizens or consumers, very often, not always, go to the point of least resistance in many respects and settle in some ways. Yeah. But talk about that concept of hurting within the context of platforms.
Well, I think over the last 5 years or so, maybe 8 years, the story of business on the internet has become fundamentally one of loyalty, verging on dependence, and trying to capture as large a herd of humanity as possible to sit on your platform. And the model, just to change metaphors, is a little bit more like a casino, where it doesn't really matter what we do when we're there, as long as you are there. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as you're checking stuff out, you know, you can doing this, doing that, you can collect fees, you can collect data, you can advertise. So I think that's become the game. And unfortunately, we're human. We're subject to it. It's very challenging to try to seek out inconvenient options. And if you know, you want my one business lesson from this book, it's that convenience is the most powerful force in human behavior right now.
And how does hurting happen then, right? I mean, you can do them with with monopolistic practices, but there's also, I would imagine, even more like insidious tactics.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about, so some of it, and I think this is pretty well documented, is the effort to make platforms addictive. You know, just like very careful study of, you know, what basically works for the gambling industry. I mean, it's crazy that so many of the business models of our major companies are borrowed from like gambling or other areas. But the other, I think, is less, you know, negative, just to rely on essentially the human trait of we're kind of a little bit lazy, you know, or we're busy or like whatever. We just do what we do. And I think that's been very powerfully built upon, you know, which I think you can judge a civilization by its the emotions it relies upon. And, you know, in our time, it's got quite a bit of anger, fear, and laziness that we're relying upon. Sorry to be so optimistic about
the world. I mean, I think there's also, you know, something to the sort of the synergy, sorry to use that word, between sort of like people having less time, having to work more to provide for sort of basic necessities, and then that same a different part of that same system providing sort of like convenience in lieu of stuff because people are so exhausted. I mean, like, you know, I think we're seeing this rise of like ordering in, you know, part of it is in the wake of COVID. I think things have changed, but part of it is also, I think people are expending more because they're having to expend more energy for less in other areas of their life. And expending more to sort of like make it easier for them to expend more to get less.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, it's quite an insightful comment. There's something wrong and almost it feels like beyond our power to do something about the fact we have not made work better. You know, when you think about like what do most people do with much of their lives, it's work. And particularly since, you know, most families to afford living today need both parents working. And look, I'm not trying to say that, but I'm just saying like that is like an economic necessity for most people. And I agree, we've sort of been squeezed. You know, here we are, the wealthiest society in human history, yet people are so squeezed they can't, like, you know, cook dinners for their family. Yeah.
Well, it's also the orientation of our economy towards an increasingly small percentage of it, the one that is most responsible for consumer spending. I mean, DoorDash and Uber Eats and stuff like that, those are people that have the ability to have that delivered to them and can spend and use that extra money when it gets delivered to them, right? We have the top 10% responsible for half of consumer spending right now. It feels like all that capital with tech is responsible in many ways for that as well.
Yes, I agree with that. And I, you know, if there's a message of this book, it's, you know, the broader goal of this book is to talk about balance in the American economic system. You know, we often talk about separation of powers, and we often talk about the need for balance between the Congress and the White House and then the courts, which I got to say is not in the best state of affairs either. But our economic balance is really out of whack. You know, and
Well, I know I want to get to that in a moment, yeah. But I also want, like, it does feel, I mean, and I've referenced this in the past. I once found a steamer trunk back in my yard sailing days with an article of a futurist talking to a ladies club in Florida in the 50s. And they were in his big thing, among other things, was that we're going to have watches that are going to give us TV from satellites, which was right, although he thought it was going to be powered by propane gas. But he did say the biggest challenge for us by the time we get into the 80s or 90s is going to be, what are we going to do? Because machines are going to help our productivity so much. What are we going to do with all the extra free time?
Yeah.
And the promise of technology, it feels like, has always been left unfettered. The promise of technology has always been, this is going to help workers or people produce more with less effort. And therefore, the challenge is going to be, what do we do with our leisure time?
Yeah.
But in fact, what happens is it's like an arms race. And that the extra value created by that productivity does not go to the people who are working, but rather to those who have deployed the technology. And it has increased exponentially, that delta between what is the extra productivity and how much actually goes to the people who are being productive.
Yes, I completely agree. This is why the word extraction is in the title of the book, because I think we are living in the age of extraction, and the extraction is of all the productivity that we all have. Exactly as you just said, you know, we individually, all of us have the capability, you know, that six people had 20 years ago in order to do stuff. But where has that surplus gone? Has it gone to the average worker, the average American? Such that they, you know, have all the time they want, and they live, you know, can live like the aristocracy lived in the 19th century. I mean, the answer is no, although we have as many possessions as people did. But generally, no. I think there's been an enormous extraction. And if you look, I mean, at monopolized corporate profit taking, it is just a very straightforward story. And the ability we gave up on balance somewhere in the 1980s and 90s and trying to refunnel back the gains of our technology to the average person. That's basically the story of the last like 50 years.
You write about, before you get to solutions in the book, you write about the dangers in it that, you know, aside from the fact that aside from the sort of just malaise that it creates for the vast majority of us, but society-wide, you write about the dangers. Talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, one part of my book, I have a section called The Real Road to Serfdom, and it's inspired by a book that people may know called The Road to Serfdom, which said that, you know, the reason you get totalitarian government is that you have, you know, well-meaning social welfare state, and it goes on and on and on and becomes, you know, Soviet Russia. But I think that quite the opposite.
A little bit ironic by quoting Hayek. We should yes. we should just tell people. I just want people to understand that.
Yeah, I think it's the opposite, which is to say, if you don't have government rebalancing and taking a role in making sure the government that the economy remains balanced, you have a predictable sequence where you know, you monopolize major industries, they extract from people. People get angry, they demand change. And if the government is unable to do anything about that, if the government cannot rebalance, cannot, you know, fix monopoly problems, cannot prevent people's wealth from being extracted, they get angry and they turn to, you know, a strong man who's really going to solve everything for them. So I think that is the situation we
familiar.
See all over the world. I mean, I wrote this before our current state of government, but It was basically, I was thinking about Venezuela, where the same things happened, and Germany during the 30s and Italy during the 20s. So, yeah, there's some real dangers from failing to deal with monopolization, extraction problems.
Let's just expand on that a little bit. You write about the sort of the persistent dream of self-correcting economies, like the and this is obviously like the Hayek neoliberal in the most specific sense, coming from Mont Pelerin, and the sort of the implication that markets will provide the solution left on their own. Although there was also an element of like, but we should also government should function in a more subtle way of helping specific industries and players in there. But why does, and I guess maybe to tie this in with the notion of like post facto redistribution is not enough.
Yes.
I mean, we talk about wealth tax on this program. We talk about the 90% tax rate for people making over what would be $3 million in today's dollars in the 50s, in the early 60s. But that's after the fact. Which,
yes.
Why is that not enough?
Yeah. Well, so there's two ideas there. The first is maybe a little more technical. You know, having worked in government multiple times in my career, in Obama, Biden, White House, and so forth, I feel that, you know, the private sector can be really important, and the market has tendencies to try and solve itself. But the idea that all of our monopoly and extraction problems are going to be solved by the market is really a fantasy we need to get over, because monopolies can be very persistent. I guess I'll put it that way, particularly as they often are when they are very good at getting the assistance of government to stay there. And, you know, I think that I'll say. The other point I think is more of a challenge to some liberals, which is I think there is a tenor of liberal thought, I think it was pretty big, particularly in the Clinton era, that says, well, it's okay to have monopoly. It's okay to have incredibly profitable corporations because we can always fix it later, and we need to grow the pie and we'll just tax it later. Okay. And the main challenge, the main problem with that theory is that the later never comes, and predictably it doesn't come, because the more money you give to people, the better they are to resist their own taxation or their own various forms of redistribution. So you're always in this situation. In fact, you'd have to sort of constantly be raising taxes all the time if you wanted to keep up with where the tax rates have gone. So, you know, you back yourself into a corner where you're now trying much, much, much later to try to pass a wealth tax, something else later. I'm not saying I'm opposed to that, and it's a decent effort, but we've set up a situation because the wealthy are good at influencing government. We've given them the means to influence government by saying, take your money and then we'll tax you later.
It's also completely nonsensical, not just from the taxation standpoint, but from the purpose of anti-monopoly laws, which is to create and foster competition. Because if you say you're just going to deal with it later, the damage is already done. I mean, the tech industry understands this. We're going to be talking about Waymo, but the Uber understood this by just doing whatever they wanted, smashing and grabbing, and then like, okay, the medallion stuff and like taxi laws, we'll deal with that later. But we're trying to race ahead of regulations, not respond to them, because we know that if we can create this market, then we can crowd out the competition, and then we will be such a staple that you can't get rid of us.
Yeah, you know, another great example is where we blew it is in social media, where, you know, this model, extremely toxic model of preying on people's worst emotions and building, you know, the most angry responses possible, then advertising on that in a very individualized way, having that being like a dominant business model, you know, for Facebook and Twitter as well, although it's gotten a lot worse. You know, once that becomes the business model and everyone thinks that's fine, you have a race to the bottom instead of the race to the top. So part of what you need to do in competition policy is try to figure out with guardrails a ways to have races to the top. And that's what I think we failed to do. But, you know, maybe we're learning our lesson. We're certainly paying for it right now.
I wanted to wait on that, but since you're at that point, algorithms. My contention is that there must be a way through antitrust law to basically say, just you can't have them. Like, you know, like I mean, more like you know, maybe I'm not even sure I would even keep like Netflix. Our suggestion for you, because as you extend out that sort of like use of algorithm, and maybe it can be as distinct of like algorithms, but not for X, Y, and Z, because it seems to me like if the theory is that we need to do this before we get to distribution, like we need to structure the making of money, because. And we're structuring it right now. It's just a question of how we're going to structure it. The idea that any government doesn't pick winners and losers, in my mind, is a fallacy. They always do. We always do, by definition. But if you get rid of algorithms, it then inhibits the ability. It's almost like the fairness doctrine in the context of you are ruining business models as a principle. And not allowing for that to accrue. Is there anything in like antitrust law that exists now or could where algorithms, I mean, surely we must have the ability to say like, this is just not a fair business practice.
You know, we have done that before. I mean, you mentioned in other forms of media that we took this, but let me back up on this a little bit. You know, individualized algorithms, which are basically trying to guess what you want and feed it to you, I feel like they're in some fundamental tension with freedom. I mean, there's something very different about a model where, you know, you go to a store or whatever, and you look around and you decide what you want, and something where people figure out who they are and try to figure out what you want and push it at you. It kind of makes whatever you are, like, what if you totally want to, let's say you love craft beer and you decide, you know, I'm going to drink Budweiser today or something. You just want to break from who you are. But we live in a world where you just kind of get bombarded with who you are over and over and over. And everybody becomes these like comic book characters of themselves. And, I feel like I know people who just have become like the worst versions of themselves. So there's even a deeper point there with the algorithm, is that it kind of stews you in your own juices. And like, that's not the best. Could you do it? I don't think antitrust law as it is. Set up for that. I know states have experimented with this. I'll tell you what the platforms say is they say that's a First Amendment right of ours to decide how we want to feed you stuff. You know, that the algorithm is no different than, let's say, the editor of the New York Times who's deciding what's going to be on the front page. Now, I happen to disagree with that. I think it's one of the many ways that an overly aggressive view of the First Amendment has taken us astray. But I think Congress could do it, could proclaim.
It's also conceptually not the same thing, because the editor can decide I'm putting this on the front page, but everybody gets that.
Right.
The owner at a supermarket could say, like, we're putting Budweiser on aisle 3 at the top in a special promotion case, and that might encourage it. But that encourages it for everyone. It is not like down to the individual. And I don't know, like, I mean, conceptually, it's not the same thing, it seems to me.
I think it's different, too. You got to convince the Supreme Court of that. And including some
other
of our
things that have to happen, I think, in terms of time and nature.
I'm including the liberal judges on that because, Justice Kagan, for example, completely buys the theory that Google's algorithm is the same thing as the New York Times editor choosing stories, or YouTube's algorithm, which I just think is different. And, you know, it's an example of something being, it's like taking an analogy and going too far. It's also not a human choosing.
Right.
I mean, I have a little more respect for a human, you know, like obviously you put some thought into what's going to be in the show. That's human judgment. And I, you know, respect that and think it's essential, frankly, but it's totally different than an automated procedure, which is just trying to figure out what, you know, works on your reptilian brain and makes you buy stuff. So I guess we couldn't be in more agreement.
I'm sort of repeating a point that you're making, but there's a lot of moral panic about, you know, us being so polarized. I mean, I think that there's some validity to it, and but it's in part because, like, you're, as you're saying, just stewing in your own stuff. Everything on social media appears to be nostalgia content at this point, and it's genuinely having, I think, like a deleterious effect on people's ability to have, you know, critical examination of the world, let alone what it's doing to kids.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It's sort of like, you know, our own, you know, we're a very sort of self-absorbed society, obviously. So what happens if you just let people, you know, live in their own narcissistic, you know, actual literal narcissistic pool, where you're sort of, you know, change my marinating in your own, like, interests and beliefs and prejudices, what happens? Well, I mean, it's pretty ugly. I think human beings look a lot better when we're kind of, you know, forced to walk in the street and see a lot of different ideas and thoughts, and, you know, that's a much healthier way to be.
Ultimately, what we're really talking about from a democracy standpoint is to inhibit the ability of some people to monopolize not just money, but political power. And so it's, I think the benefit is that we end up becoming more interesting people and have more fulfilling lives. But as a pure, like, sort of like from a democracy function, inhibiting people from becoming our society becoming a plutonomy and then to a plutocracy is really the name of the game. And, you know, we've interviewed folks about antitrust on this program, certainly over the past 10, 15 years. Almost to a person, we hear largely, we don't even need a new set of laws. The laws are on the books. We are, particularly in the Biden administration, coming out of an era where the perspective on antitrust had been perverted in some way by Robert Bork in the Chicago School, in this notion of consumer value, and it just was a reinterpretation of antitrust away from the fundamental principles of antitrust, which was sort of like a democracy project, both economic democracy and in terms of civil democracy. But in the same way, I'm curious, as in the same way that you need to sort of structure our commerce and our economy in a way to inhibit people from accruing a concentrated amount of wealth, what is the mechanism to inhibit Ronald Reagan Part Two coming in and just reinterpreting the laws in such a way that you could fundamentally derail antitrust over the course of 4 or 5 decades without having to really change the laws?
That's a good question. First, I'm happy to hear that the antitrust change message back to the original vision has sunk in with you in that way, because I think that has been the project.
We've got a little hiccup going on right now, but
but the long term is the most important, and these are like constitutional level values. I mean, at some level, I don't want to be critical of the U.S. Constitution, but at some level, it was a mistake by the founders not to include an anti-monopoly provision, which they debated having in there. because at some level, the decentralization of power is the goal of the Constitution. You know, no one branch, no one part of government, including federal or state, should have all the power. But what was left out of that was private power. And, you know, it's clear in our times that we have private entities that have, you know, as much, if not more power than individual states, and sometimes can overwhelm the federal government. And we kind of forgot about that. Okay, things were different in the 18th century. So if you wanted to have a long-term project, you'd have to think of the decentralization of economic power of having a constitutional imperative. And, you know, adding to the Constitution is one thing, or just having it be understood, which sometimes is how things work, that this is a constitutional level imperative, and we cannot allow there to be such incredible imbalances and still maintain a democracy.
Yeah, you know, some time ago we interviewed, it was, I think, Fishkin and Forbath who had written the Anti-Oligarchy Constitution. And it seems like, you know, like in the parlance of 250 years ago, being against the king was to be against the oligarch and the oligarchy and the concentration of wealth and i.e. power. We've lost sight of that, I guess. And so the how does one reintroduce that notion so that if Robert Bork comes back and decides that we're going to reinterpret this antitrust law that you or some other group has the ability to sue the federal government and say, what you're doing is fundamentally unconstitutional or, if not, statutorily wrong because you're not applying the antitrust standards in the way that it's written.
I mean, what's crazy about it is some of it comes down to an embrace of a conservative idea, which is originalism, which is, you know, that you have to respect the original. Actually, the conservatives love originalism when it comes to the Constitution. They don't like it when it comes to statutes because the original intent of the antitrust statute, the Sherman Act, was to prevent protect workers, farmers, consumers, and against like monster corporations. That's the original intent. Anyone who reads it honestly, and to prevent, you know, a political aggregation of power so that you have a monarchy in the private sector. That is like so obviously the intent. And if you read it, it's very hard to deny it. So one answer is just, you know, we anchor ourselves back to reading the antitrust statutes in light of the intent of Congress. And if that is the understood method, you're fine. You know, the way people have run away from that is to say, well, yeah, everything has to be understood in terms of contemporary economics. But my view has been, you know, the antitrust laws are laws. Congress had its reasons for them, and they're anchored in some of our constitutional values, and that's how they need to be interpreted.
From your perspective as a law professor, has it changed in the institution of law schools, the interpretation of antitrust sufficiently that you feel some confidence that going forward, as we produce more judges, that that concept has been sort of internalized?
I think when change happens, it happens, you know, it fits and starts. It's funny you should mention that I spent the morning working on our casebook. Lena Khan and I are writing a casebook, a few other people, Zephyr Teachout, Shell Sussman, are writing a casebook in our field, which, like, you know, is meant to make front and center what the original point of these laws were. So I think the student, first of all, I mean, the amount of student interest we have in anti-monopoly work is incredible. All of our classes are completely full with huge waiting lists. And a lot of people just seem to want to devote their lives to these projects. I guess it shows you that there is a hunger to try to do something to fight this. So I think it's sinking in. Look, obviously, people are very cynical about the Trump administration. But I also think that some of the fundamental principles of our country are less about administrations and more about what's taken for granted. And certainly when I was, say, in the Obama White House, it was taken for granted that it was only about like neoliberal economics. And I think that's totally changed. So there's a sign of optimism.
That's a great place to end. Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University, author of Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered Our Economy and Threatened Our Future Prosperity. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link, obviously, to that at majority.fm in our YouTube and podcast description. Thanks again. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, folks. I'm going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have fun.
Yes, we will.
Really cool. Reminds us that Bezos fired 300 journalists from the Washington Post last week. Unclear how many minutes of the Melania film that would have cost to maintain those salaries.
Derek Thompson rushed to Twitter to say, it's like he doesn't care about the media. Whoa. Thanks for that insight.
He left. he left.
Just negligence. It's not an attack on your entire industry. It's just negligence.
They left journalists like stranded on assignment all across the world. Absolutely unconscionable.
The Ross Perot thing about the drain and this
giant sucking sound.
Yeah, like that's been happening in media for the entirety of our lives. Like,
well, he was talking about the jobs going overseas.
Because of NAFTA, right?
Yes.
But the press, you look at the employment and people employed by as journalists for the past 50 years, it's been cratering. And the people employed to sell PR or marketing has been rising. This is a long term trend, and we're going to see it just collapse now. It's over.
I can't remember now, like if this, because it was, we went through a period where we would talk about this all the time. Maybe it was in the aughts, but as recently as 30, 40 years ago, like news organizations at networks were basically a lost leader. Like they didn't make any money. And they were simply the way that you sort of like it was part of your responsibility. And newspapers and media outlets have simply become mechanisms in which to sell as opposed to like some notion of civic duty or whatnot.
It's also, I mean, it's the influencerification also of information on the internet. Everything is pay to play now. Most of the posts that you're seeing on social media, they're being elevated to the top because it's pay to play. It sounds silly, but you see these, like, the rise, as Matt's saying, of public relations, even in movie campaigns. Like, they're this horrible interpretation, I can tell already, it's going to be horrible, of Wuthering Heights is coming out. And, like, they're pretending that they were in love just for that couple is, just the two stars, just for 2 weeks so they can get social media hype. Like everything
well,
is.
Well, that's an old used to actually do that.
But you're seeing it. I mean, I'm not trying to go like that movie that was really funny with Pamela Anderson and Liam Neeson. They also faked being in a relationship for like two. I mean, like it sounds silly, but all of the information that's out there right now is designed to create engagement as opposed to like proliferating truth. And we're wondering why these legacy outlets aren't fully covering what we're seeing in the Epstein files. There's basically no journalists, and the ones that are left are not inclined to dig that deep into this kind of thing. Like, Maggie Haberman was the big reporter at the New York Times during the first Trump administration. You look into her background, her father was like a PR guy for the Trumps. It's elites in our media that are replicating the same message and not challenging power in anything in any meaningful way.
With that said, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, not only get the free show free of commercials, you also get the fun half, and you can IM us on the fun half. Someone just asked Daredevil on the IM, are you taking calls today? Maybe. We don't, that level of planning.
Don't put pressure on us.
Yeah, exactly. But we might. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. What's there seems to be like a concern brewing in the
YouTube bullshit
in the tech area. Matt, what's happening on the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, there's a new Jacobin. Before that YouTube issue, I was gonna look up what we did on Friday. Go check out the Tuesday show 10. o'clock. We had Robin Wansley on talking about Minnesota, and Chip Gibbons talking about this new idea that reporting on members of our armed services is doxing them.
Oh.
Which, God, I'm getting too old for this.
Tell me about it.
Patreon.com/A Left Reckoning to get our Sunday show where we talk about the Epstein Files, including Kimball Musk, who... Well, he went on a podcast, and people should have to check out Left Reckoning or get David and I.
Is that Musk's what, brother or father?
Yeah, his cooler older brother.
And what does he say? Like,
he wears a cowboy hat. He plays guitar.
He went on to. It doesn't matter what the podcast was, but he went on to a podcast to talk about the worst period of his life, which was his divorce,
of course,
and which actually kind of led to like the other time that he needed a triple intervention from people because of how much partying he was doing. And turns out some recent emails may have set some insight into the type of party he was doing and why an intervention was needed by three different people.
Are you trying to tell me that the guy in the cowboy hat who's divorced, who is singing an acoustic guitar song in a very closed setting and an intimate one, is in some way, I don't know, having a midlife crisis?
I think he's the exact type of person we need to entrust the priorities of our economy to. I think these guys are great at allocating capital, and I look forward to the future that they're all creating for us.
Ah, you know what sucks too? Now we're not going to Mars.
We were this close.
We're going to the moon.
We just needed to hear Kimball
Musk.
So
close.
We just needed to let him do a live set at Burning Man on his acoustic, and we could have data centers on the moon right now.
And he's
now.
Such a pathological liar.
I mean, the line where he's like, the Mars would have taken 25 years, but we can do the moon in 10.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Sure, buddy. Give us more investment money. Any day now.
Here's an idea for a member feed of you two guys, like when there's like a problem with YouTube. Because usually, like, I look over and it's just like, everybody's just sort of like that.
Swipe left, swipe left.
And then all of a sudden, I look
not
up
me,
and
it's like, record.
Oh no. Like, what's going on?
We're having an emotional breakdown.
That's the panic when we have to work.
And the annoyance. It's like when you're working.
Things aren't automated. What's going on?
That's the thing. It's like when you're. It reminds me of like working at McDonald's when we were like 30 minutes from close and a big bus would come through. It's like you.
Yeah, right.
Making me have to get my hands dirty again.
All right. See you in the fun house.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way!
Unbelievable.
This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
We are back, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland, Fun Half, Majority Report, Mondays. Holt to Cowell. NASA did the moon in 10 years in the 60s. Let's see what excuse Elon comes up with.
All these regulations.
Yeah, need more taxpayer money, I guess.
Let's start with this one and two. Then we'll move into Donald Trump. And then the culture war that broke out at the Super Bowl.
Oh, yes.
Ball with the ball.
I mean, oh, my God. They really couldn't come up with anybody else.
I know.
But, all right, we'll get to that.
Yeah. Kevin Sorbo was busy.
He also had, like, Chip Truck or something singing.
Chip Truck. Red Solo Cup.
What about the Richmond over Richmond guy? Richmond over, what was it? What's his name?
Oliver.
What was the name of the guys?
Oliver North.
What was the name of that? What was the name of that band? Bush Was Right.
Oh yeah, what were
Remember
they doing?
Remember those guys?
Bush Was Right.
All
right,
let's.
The Wright Brothers.
There have been more and more stories that we're starting to see about the U.S. government essentially trying to create a network of concentration camps. They're going around buying up warehouses to create these detention centers with the goal of being able to detain an extra 80,000 people. They are all across the country. Apparently, according to a video put out by Pat, what's the District 18?
Ryan.
Pat Ryan, congressman from District 18. They are looking at 8 regional centers and then more satellite detention centers around those 8 regional centers. These are buildings that are in no way set up to accommodate people. And we have now seen clips of like what people are being put through in these concentration camps.
Yeah.
Here is let's play this clip. This is from CBS Washington D.C. WUSA 9.
And you may have seen this clip at the beginning. We played this of the how tight and these conditions are with the blankets over them that was leaked out of this Baltimore detention center.
Right.
But this local news station was able to get a former ICE worker to speak to them on the condition of anonymity about what he saw there, and it's disturbing.
Interview.
We're disguising the identity of a former worker here at the ICE detention facility on the 6th floor of this federal building in Baltimore because they signed a non-disclosure agreement before starting work here, which means they could face legal retaliation for talking about it.
People laying on the floor, head to toe. That reminded me of the pictures that I saw in elementary school of how they brought the slaves. From Africa.
For months, this person had access to what our cameras are not allowed to see.
Miren cómo nos tienen aquí. Miren cómo migración cómo nos tienen.
The inside of the same Baltimore ICE detention center showed in this viral video.
Nos tienen en un depósito aquí en Baltimore.
The former worker showed WUSA 9 documentation proving they were employed there.
It was probably day one or day two that I saw the abuse.
What did you see?
I saw people laying in feces, people throwing up, people laying in urine.
At the time, an ICE spokesperson blamed the overcrowding on widespread flight cancellations and severe weather conditions that made it nearly impossible for ICE to safely transfer detainees to long-term detention facilities. In a new statement this week to WUSA 9, ICE went further, adding flatly, overcrowding does not happen.
Did you witness overcrowding that was worse than what we saw in that video?
Yes. Yes, I did.
But this former worker provided WUSA 9 with what they claim are internal headcount sheets from December, showing conditions worse than in that viral video. 47, 50, and 56 detainees in that same cell, more than the worker counted in the video itself, and as many as 50 detainees in an even smaller cell. A federal class action lawsuit filed last May alleges conditions similar to what this former worker described to us and seen in the video. And when Maryland Congresswoman April McLean Delaney toured the facility last Friday, she said she was disturbed by what she saw.
It is just a horrific thing for us as a country.
This former worker told us on one occasion they showed up to find a detainee strapped in a restraint chair.
And when I asked the guard why was he in the restraint chair, his reply to me was that the mother kept making noise all night.
In its statement, ICE told WUSA 9 restraints are only used if a detainee poses a danger to themselves or others, never for disciplinary reasons, and not for extended periods. Staff are trained in their proper use, and all instances are monitored. The spokesperson also said ICE is committed to the safety, health, and dignity of all individuals in custody.
For
this
sure.
Former worker told us he regularly saw detainees lying in filth, and treatment of women's sanitary needs was especially disturbing.
We didn't always have sanitary stuff for them if they were having their cycle.
What was the solution there?
They were given diapers.
ICE told WUSA 9 appropriate hygiene supplies, including sanitary products, for female detainees are provided, and that all staff and contractors treat detainees with respect and dignity. But the former worker showed us these screenshots of a group text message in which a coworker complains about the smell inside the facility. Someone messages back, smells like an animal house at the zoo. A third person seems to joke, goats.
And that's how I've seen some of the officers treat them and talk to them out of the Baltimore office like they were animals in a cage at the zoo. I'm for the deportation of illegal immigrants in this country, especially those that commit crimes. I've said it when I got hired. I said it in the interview. I knew who I was working for when I took this job. I had no problems with doing my job. I just have problems with the abuse and the treatment of the...
Yeah.
I mean, there is absolutely no reason to believe that this type of stuff isn't going on at these other detention facilities, particularly because we have reports of people purposely being put in these type of conditions as a way of getting them to short circuit their own legal process that they are already involved in to get legal status in this country. I mean, time and time again, there was a story of we talked about this the other day, about that lawyer who told the judge in Minneapolis, like, put me in contempt of court so that I can get a nap, you know, rest for 24 hours.
She was fired, by the way.
And she was fired.
Yeah.
But that judge in that case also made the point, and it got sort of ignored. The U.S. District Court Judge Jerry Blackwell said the overwhelming majority of people brought to his court by U.S. Immigration and Customs and Customs and Border Protection since the Trump administration's crackdown started have been lawfully present in the country. That doesn't necessarily mean they have citizenship. It just means that they are here
within a legal process. It may be getting their asylum cases adjudicated. It may be on the way to getting a green card. It may be on the way to getting citizenship. Whatever it is, they are lawfully present here. And what's happening is these people are getting scooped up. They're being stuck in these detention facilities. They're essentially being tortured in some fashion or another, living in these squalor-like conditions as a way of basically having them say, coercing them into saying, I give up my rights in the context of this legal process that I'm involved in, and you can send me out of the country just so I can get out of this living hell that you put me in.
There's an old video of Stephen Miller in high school talking about torture and speaking about how torture is, quote, a celebration of life and human dignity, because he says that tortured people can live, and that should be that is a form of a celebration of life. I mean, to not do so would just be to essentially kill people. Then that's in extermination camps that we're talking about here. And could that happen in this situation? I mean, what would be stop? Why would we be credulous about that? I mean, it's important to say what the possibilities are here, because these are definitionally concentration camps. And when they were sending people to CECOT and they were shaving those men's heads and binding them together and humiliating them and torturing them and keeping lights on at all hours and sexually assaulting them, that the reason that they sent them there was because they couldn't necessarily get away with doing that at home. But right now they're going to try everything up into that point.
The this hearing that took place last Tuesday, where the judge, I mean, the attorney basically said this job sucks, was subsequently fired. The judge in that February 3rd hearing said the overwhelming majority of the 100 seen by this court have been found to be lawfully present. They live in their communities. Some are separated from their families. The reason for the hearing on Tuesday was, quote, compliance with court orders, with Blackwell seeking answers from the federal government on why lawful citizens are being held in custody when they, quote, should have been left alone and, quote, not arrested in the first place. Understand what's happening here with this. There are more and more instances of the Department of Justice and ICE, separate agencies, ignoring court orders. You'll read stories of ICE was required to not deport somebody, and they had already deported them, and they're not going to bring them back. And the problem is these courts are afraid to bring it to a head, because that's when you start to have a sort of recognized constitutional crisis. And it's sort of like, you know, the analogy would be like you're in a relationship and you're conflict avoiding, because you know if you hit the real conflict, you're going to have to break up. And maybe you have kids and you don't want to deal with the divorce.
Can I act like I never saw those text messages?
Exactly. Because a lot of these judges are in courts that aren't high enough where they feel like they may have the authority to make the administration come to it, and they also don't want to be responsible for this constitutional crisis to become that obvious in their jurisdiction.
But what's horrifying is that people are, we already know people are dying in ICE detention, and we know that ICE has stopped paying medical detainee treatment since October. And if these are the conditions that people are in, sleeping in urine and feces and women in diapers because they have no pads or tampons for them, the amount of squalor and the unsanitary conditions means that people are going to be dying and they're experiencing severe health issues at this current moment. And there's no oversight. I mean, is an NDA for that kind of work standard practice?
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, what?
This is the government.
The government is now issuing NDAs? I mean, I could see it. You know, I could see it. Obviously, like if you're working in Intel, national secrets.
But ding, 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 ding. That's what it is. It's because ICE and DHS are an outgrowth of the national security state. They're using those same tactics that you would some sort of mercenary abroad. It's the imperial boomerang. I mean, I know that some people don't like that term for this. I think that Cesare was on point about it, but saying that, like, yeah, there are slave catchers and others where that you can draw parallels to American history, and we shouldn't say that this hasn't been tactics that have been used against Black people and brown people in this country for quite a while. But I think it's important to frame it that way when you're looking at the systemic structure of the agency, because point taken on that, but in the way that ICE and DHS is structured, it's definitionally the imperial boomerang.
It's much harder,
yes,
to do what we did with slave catching today because of the way our government and laws that have built up over the years. But if you slot this into
national
homeland security and yep. national security, things get a lot loosey-goosier.
And it's outside of the DOJ and of like our traditional law enforcement apparatus. We are using tactics that we have used abroad on U.S. soil right now, and including torture.
Here's another clip. Minnesota still in the grips, despite the fact that Tom Homan is trying to make it seem like things have calmed down. We know in Maine, they have taken out some of the enforcement because they're worried. And this was reported by Brian Kilmeade. The White House is worried about Susan Collins' reelection. And so they have pulled back on their ICE targeting in Maine, which, I mean, as if we needed to have any evidence beyond what we have that this is completely a political project as opposed to a national security project, and that the notion of violent immigrants is a made-up excuse for what they're doing. We have another example out of Minnesota where there is still this onslaught of these federal goons coming in, conceding what they're doing there and why. Here is a clip. This is from Coon Rapids, Minnesota, posted by Unicorn Riot on X.
Is the more people that you lose in Minnesota, then lose a voting right to stay blue. This job has been around way before I was even born.
The stark difference is that there wasn't this much violence when it was under Obama.
But yes. This administration has been more transparent than the Biden administration.
Well, I would love to talk about that more. Can you tell me more what you mean by that? Like, what specifically do you feel like Trump's been more transparent with?
Every time you get a serious arrest,
the guy talking about transparency is wearing a mask, by the way.
Yeah, he's literally wearing a mask. And he's arguing that nothing's changed between the Trump administration and the Obama administration. And then, okay, except that maybe a little more violent, but there's been much more transparency. Which I guess is sort of his way of saying, like, they're being explicit about their purification project.
Right. Well, also, can a right-winger have an argument on its merits about the tactics that ICE and DHS is using across the country? Or does it have to be this, like, shallow whataboutism, hypocrisy-shaming stuff? You want to have a systemic conversation about Obama's role in not dismantling these very systems? We're here for it, but it's just using to deflect from the horror of his actions and his colleagues' actions.
Continue.
Like, what specifically do you feel like Trump's been more transparent with?
Every time you get a serious arrest, you put it out, right? But media does not want to show you that, especially blue state media, because it doesn't fit their narrative. The reason why, and I'm going to be clear, the reason why they don't want the population.
Can I step closer so I can hear you? Okay.
The reason why they don't want the population to go down in Minnesota is the more people that you lose in Minnesota, then lose a voting right to stay blue.
Well, if you're only taking illegals, we're not losing any voters.
That's wrong, because technically they're trying to pass a bill and they don't require you to be a citizen to vote in the election.
Oh, really? I didn't hear about that.
All right, pause it. I just want to go over what was just the exchange to give you a sense of how deluded these guys are.
God.
He is saying the reason why blue state media doesn't tell you the truth about what we're doing here is because they are afraid that they're going to lose people who are voting blue in Minnesota, and that the state will not stay as blue if we take these people. And the woman says, but if you're taking so-called illegals, then we're not losing any votes. And he goes, well, that's not true. And then he shifts to, well, they're trying to pass a law that says if you're illegal, you can vote. So even in the context of his own assertion, he is already backtracking it off of that. And incidentally, we should also add, there is no law that is being passed. The only thing is that there is an attempt on the federal level to essentially disenfranchise something like 60 million Americans because they don't have a real ID or a passport.
Yeah, I have to take my freaking passport to vote now is fucking ludicrous. And I resent every Nazi who like peddles this, including Joe Rogan, who is still on this dumb bullshit, which is this is why they're doing it. Some people say it's because of jobs. A lot of people now, the right wing, is because this is their excuse for why Republicans have only won the popular vote like a couple times in the past like half century.
But what's fascinating about this is that this guy is like is a surrounded level informed and is sure of himself. Like this guy is convinced he's right and is essentially might as well be talking about there's actual proof of aliens who've landed on this planet.
You guys have said it to Congress.
It's total. There are kids going into schools. They are pooping in kitty litter, and there's kitty litter in the schools because they're identifying
as cats.
My
friend told me.
And, like, it's that level of assuredness this guy is talking about. And I'm quite convinced he believes it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Nazi horseshit.
Yeah.
Is there any more to this? Just go back a little bit so people can hear that again, that exchange.
Right. To stay blue.
Well, if you're only taking illegals, we're not losing any voters.
That's wrong, because technically they're trying to pass a bill that doesn't require you to be a citizen to vote in the election.
Oh, really? I didn't hear about that.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. I didn't know about that. Can I ask you another question?
GNC 6164.
She didn't know about that because it's not true.
Texas plates.
Incidentally, a piece in The Atlantic. Undocumented immigrants have a lower rate of committing crimes than ICE. Like actual, like the criminal records of people who have joined ICE, and this is even prior to this surge, have a greater rate of committing crimes than undocumented immigrants. Now, I imagine a lot of those are DUIs. Nevertheless, vast majority of people they're going after are like, or at least when they started, was DUI 15 years ago, or got caught with a joint 15 years ago.
Got in a fight in front of a bar like 12 years
exactly.
ago.
Exactly.
Yeah. The Cato Institute, not a left-wing organization, came out with a study, I guess it was last week, about immigrants' impact on government budgets as well. You know, you'll hear the other Nazi lies that they're taking away from your social services. Cato Institute found that immigrants have reduced deficits by $14.5 trillion since 1994. When you look at government programs specifically, if they're paying certain kinds of taxes but they're unable to use social services like Social Security or Medicare, or say buy into the Affordable Care Act exchanges, they're prevented from doing that statutorily as well, then yeah, they're literally paying and subsidizing our already threadbare social safety net and they're not able to reap the benefits. That's how it works. It's not the other way around.
Rural Lefty, Sam, have you did you already talk about the NDAs required by staff to the U.S. Supreme Court? Soon after the November 2024 election, Chief Justice and voting rights opponent John Roberts required for the first time a formal contract with court employees. But aren't these employees government workers and represented by unions that would oppose NDAs? I don't know about that last part, but I did read this story. It was in the wake.
The abortion thing, right?
Of the abortion thing. Well, I mean, the first abortion leak came, the first leak came back in the run-up to the Obamacare case in 2013, I think it was, or 2012. And it's quite obvious that it came from Alito, went to the Wall Street Journal, if I remember correctly, and this round did too. It is an attempt to, I think, ostensibly to stop leaks, but what I actually think it is an attempt to be silence anybody who might have information as to who provided those leaks. Remember, they did a deep dive investigation at the Supreme Court and came up with nothing, couldn't figure it out.
Mm.
As if there's that many people who have access to first drafts of decisions written by justices. I mean, it is laughable. Laughable. That I'm quite convinced that NDA is to protect some judges who okayed leaks that were meant to pressure their colleagues. I mean, let me be explicit. I think Alito wanted to pressure Roberts and others on the abortion case and leaked because Roberts was contemplating, and maybe he had Kavanaugh or I doubt Amy Coney Barrett, possibly, I'm not sure, but wanted to influence their votes. And I think the last thing Roberts wants, despite the fact that he might be upset with Alito, is the court to sort of like crumble and fall apart.
Yeah.
Which is what we want.
Yes.
It is antithetical to public service to have non-disclosure agreements in government. I'm not sure why I need to say that kind of thing.
It's insane.
Insane. Like, it's one thing, and I don't agree with this, but it's one thing if you're some sort of military contractor. I don't agree with it. I'm just saying, like, it's another thing if you're working for the court.
United Kingdom operates under parliamentary sovereignty, meaning parliament can override judicial decisions. Nordic countries, Sweden, Finland, Norway. While democratic, these nations traditionally prioritize the legislature as the arbiter of constitutional issues, although they maintain a strong rule of law. Netherlands and Switzerland generally do not have a tradition of judicial review to invalidate acts of parliament. The idea that we need this is ridiculous. Yeah. And I know people are squeamish about these sorts of constitutional revolt. We need to do it. Like, it needs to be in the horizon of our movements that we get rid of the Supreme Court. It should have been done in the previous generations, but there's no way we have any sort of route forward where this power is allowed to stand.
Somebody asked me what was that citation for that ICE and undocumented. It was it's in the Atlantic. Magazine, and give me 1 second. Let's see. Well, you can find it.
It's definitely in the Atlantic, I remember.
Yeah. But... And Garrett Graff might be the source of that.
A recent guest of the show. Wrote a good book on the Nixon Watergate.
There's an Adam Sturwer article in the Atlantic that sources this.
Okay. I mean, that's it. I think it's Sturwer, maybe somebody else. I mean, they all probably have got a hold of that stat. Let's check in on the economy, shall we? Is that what this clip is?
Yep.
This is number three?
Yes.
14 years ago, things were really anemic in the economy because it was in the wake of the financial crisis. And the Obama administration had decided sometime in around 2010 or so that 2009, I guess, that they weren't going to bail out homeowners who would then subsequently bail out the banks. They voted upon in 2009 a rescue package that was two-thirds, it was $700 billion, if I remember correctly, maybe $750, two-thirds of which were actually tax cuts. So there was not much stimulus put into the economy. We had anemic job growth over the course of almost like the entire Obama administration. It grew, but very, very slow because you had foreclosures and you had not that much money in the economy. And when you give tax cuts, it is not targeted and it doesn't, people tend not to necessarily spend, et cetera, et cetera. It was anemic.
Particularly after a massive recession, what you would expect.
Exactly, as people are digging themselves out of the hole. And so by 2012, when Obama was then also going out and had pivoted to austerity in 2010, because that's what Robert Rubin and his crew told him to do, and Larry Summers told him to do, people were pretty down on the economy.
I mean, the Democrats lost 1,000 seats in 2010 because that recovery.
Well, not 2010, but
of the course of Obama.
They got slaughtered in 2010, but they got they lost 1,000 seats over the course of his 8 years.
But the slaughter in 2010, that massive red wave that brought in the Tea Party, was in part because the economy was still not working for people.
And but we've reached that level again. Here is. The NBC, I can't remember the name of the guy, interviewing Donald Trump in the Oval Office. Lots of gold. Go ahead.
You said you inherited a mess from President Biden when it comes to the economy. But at what point is it on you? At what point are we in the Trump economy?
Oh, I'd say we're there now. I'm very proud of it. 5.6%. You know, we have a GDP of 5.6 despite a shutdown. We had a 42-day shutdown. I call it the Democrat shutdown. And because of that, I lost a point and a half. I would have been in a 7 GDP, which hasn't been seen, I don't know, ever, maybe. Maybe ever.
Yeah.
And I think 26 is even going to be better. You know, we have hundreds of billions of dollars pouring into our country. Actually, trillions. $18 trillion is being invested in our country as we speak. And there are factories and plants and thousands of businesses being built all over the country. Nobody has ever seen it. I just spoke to President Xi of China.
Pause
Nobody
it for a second.
Has ever seen.
I just want to pose a question to all of you. Let's say there were thousands of factories being built around the country. By what means would you build those factories? Like what would it take to build thousands of factories?
I don't know.
I mean, would you need people?
Yes.
Concrete?
Like, would you need to hire people?
Yeah.
Construction numbers are anemic in terms of employment. The number of jobs in the private sector alone, like, if they were all construction, wouldn't mean anything. Like, clearly, the GDP for that quarter is up, and we've talked about this. But the economy is such now that the people who are making that money is probably a function of like a handful of CEOs who are making their money on AI stocks. But
that's what the construction is too. The construction is these data centers, which are giant, ideally in the minds of the investors, job destroying robots.
But construction is down, to Sam's point. And like there was an article in it, I think it was the Wall Street Journal that was in our packet today about the economy. And they were showing how all of these like areas, this one of the more major Texas concrete suppliers saw that their concrete use fell 60% in the back half of the year last year. And that's because, well, in part, because a lot of those jobs that were construction jobs or things like that, it was immigrants that were taking some of that. And the only jobs that are being added right now are in the healthcare sector.
That's... because we're an aging population.
And when he's looking at the GDP and like the stock market, yeah, that's artificially right now being inflated by an AI speculative bubble that's eventually going to burst.
Biden had good GDP growth too.
He was saying
the same stuff.
But he owns the economy. It's mine now. It's really good.
All over the country. Nobody has ever seen it. I just spoke to President Xi of China. Nobody has ever seen anything like what's happening right now in America.
When will we see those jobs and those factories open? Because manufacturing has been down.
Well, you're already seeing it in construction because they're all building. You know, we have factories being built. Car plants are coming in from Canada, coming in from Mexico. They're leaving Germany, Japan. They're all coming into the United States. And you're seeing it in your construction numbers. And, you know, the plant, we have to build them. And the plants are under construction.
In
and
your
over
term,
the,
you think those plants will open in your term?
They'll be opening up over the next year and a half,
We also lost manufacturing jobs net in his first term. It's way worse this time around, and we're a year and change in. And also, it's not just, like, of course, the immigration piece that this government is terrorizing workers that would traditionally be working those jobs. It's also the fact that inputs and raw materials are a lot more expensive because of his tariff regime. That's part of the problem. Nothing's being built because everything's too expensive and they don't have the workforce.
And why can't our press recognize this? It's because they really just care, like a lot of people in this country with power, about what their stock portfolio is doing. So as long as that's fine, there's no critical questions to be asked. There's no holding these people's feet to the fire. They can say whatever. China says they've never seen anything like it. Look at China.
She was so jealous.
Look at what China's doing. Again, pick a random city in like the top 100 most populous Chinese cities, and I'll tell you what, it's way more impressive than whatever number randomly you pick in the U.S. They are actually producing things over there. They have cars that Canada wants to make. Like, they are cleaning our clocks because of the productive capacity they're developing, while our like pedophile class of or Epstein class of losers laugh all the way to the bank and talk about like making America great again or whatever.
Are you trying to say that Trump, in his golden White House or Oval Office, who's building the Gilded Age style ballroom right outside that door, is more concerned with the class of people that own an overwhelming majority of the stocks? Top 10% of earners in this country own 90% of the stocks in this country. And that's the economy? That the class of people that he serves, it would behoove the Democrats to make that clear.
Well, speaking of which, here's a clip of John Ossoff running in Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if he's the first politician I've seen quote Matt here, but
I think it was the Epstein class stuff. We were saying that last week and we were trying to figure out who was the politician who'd said it first. Apparently it's Ro Khanna who coined the term. It's a useful term. So I'm glad to see that Ossoff and others are talking about it and use it interchangeably with billionaires.
Anything that dehumanizes billionaires.
Exactly.
Yep.
Now, you remember, we were told that MAGA was for working class Americans. You remember that? But this is a government of, by, and for the ultra rich. It is the wealthiest cabinet ever. This is the Epstein class ruling our country. They are the elites they pretend to hate. So prices are up, jobs are going away, Medicaid and school lunches are slashed, nursing homes are getting defunded. If you're Steve Bannon, And your pitch was Trump for the forgotten man and woman. How do you sell any of this? Trump was supposed to fight for the working class. Instead, he's literally closing rural clinics and hospitals to cut taxes for George Soros and Elon Musk. He was supposed to end the globalist world police foreign policy. Instead, we're doing war for oil and nation building again and threatening to conquer Greenland. He was supposed to drain the swamp. Instead, this is the most corrupt administration of all time, and everybody knows it. Everybody knows it.
Ossoff's been hot on the anti-corruption messaging for quite a while. He knows what he's doing with that kind of stuff. And he'll make a wonderful VP for AOC.
Also interesting that he's talking about Soros. Like, he's not playing the good billionaire, bad billionaire game.
Yeah.
Which I think is very helpful. I will tell you, I do think that if there was a sleeper candidate in 2028, I would be surprised. I mean, it's really a function of how he does in this election, his reelection in 2026. But if he does pretty well in that election, look for that guy to run for president.
If he's running against Derek Dooley, he's going to kill him.
That's the thing. We'll see.
Oh, he's running for president. I mean, Ossoff's jumping in. I would be shocked if he's not running for president.
You don't see him included in the lists.
Well, I mean, but if he ends up winning in 2026, God willing, then he has like a lot of runway, and he can just go back to the Senate if he needs to, because he has. He could just do his first 2 years, make it elevate your profile, run for president, or, you know, we'll see. Yeah. So.
And I've also noticed he's not as Barack Obama sounding as he used to be.
He's found his voice.
It takes a while. I mean, it takes exactly. He's starting to get into like his own cadence. There's still a little bit you can hear. But
let Josh Shapiro do
it.
That
took
horrible.
Me a long time when I was doing stand up to get out of Rodney Dangerfield, and then
that'd be hilarious to see you doing Roger.
It took me a while to get out of Louie when I started.
Speaking of Shapiro, meanwhile, he's still like, I mean, Ossoff's doing this kind of stuff, and Shapiro, who clearly wants to run for president in 2028, is like, you know, still mired in drama with the Kamala Harris campaign, as if people care about this. Like, if you're not going out there and talking about billionaires, you're getting left behind in the voters' minds.
He is a fascinating test case, because this is a guy who, like, he sat down with his consultants and they looked at the potential field and they were just like, because the whole thing is what they're all trying to do right now is figure out what lane they're going to be in. And what's going to be – there's two things. What's going to be the lane that's going to attract the most voters? And what's the lane that they can fit into and own? And
can attract money.
And can attract money. And the problem that Shapiro has is that you have to be – that one, he sees the one lane he can own is to be almost the furthest right.
Yeah.
On a whole host of issues. But you have to delude yourself that this is the lane that can win. And I am sorry. Like,
and Newsom's going to do that better than you, buddy. Like,
well, I don't think Newsom is moving to, like, I don't think Newsom's going to go to the right of Shapiro.
I mean, he's saying he's not on board with like the billionaire tax, for example, and he was cozying up to Charlie Kirk and Steve Bannon.
I still think that Newsom looks at himself as like some type of compromise between Shapiro and somebody else.
Okay.
Whoever that's going to be. I mean, I don't think that's going to work out for him either. But I think the real question is like, who Ossoff come from Georgia? Like, how many, you know, like of these people, like, you know, Shapiro's going to push, like, I'm coming from a purple state. Well, Georgia's pretty purple to the extent that it's even, you know, I don't know what's the color that's more red than purple. But it's magenta.
You would say pink. Pink, right?
I have no idea.
But like in political parlance.
He's going to have a coming from the south, not being from sort of the northeast. That twang is going to get a little more pronounced. And
Jimmy Carter all over again.
Exactly. But he's speaking populism.
Yeah. Well, he'll be a great VP. Yeah. He'll be a great VP.
He's also got more. He can go further on Gaza than others because he's Jewish. And Shapiro, like, that, it's an interesting dynamic.
It is. There are some good contenders, but I feel like my eyes are a little bit bigger than not bigger than
Emma's
my stomach.
In the bag for AOC.
Let me get this straight. I'm not promoting Ossoff. I'm just saying that, like, this is, I'm just analyzing his what I think the conversation he's having with his consultants, his advisors, and what others are ultimately going to have. I don't think AOC is going to run for president, but she might.
In 2028. She's definitely going to run at some point.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's a very potent time if she decides to run. And the Democrats are going to need to address the fallout with the Latino vote with Donald Trump. And I wouldn't
be surprised if she ends up being somebody's vice presidential.
She should not settle for that.
But
she's the leader of the party at this moment.
They should give her some formal powers first.
Agree. Or she takes it by the sheer popular will. And that's what she has the ability to do that because she's that popular.
I think she could win in a I think it's possible she could win a Democratic primary. I wonder if it is a risk that she's willing to take. If she doesn't win, it's one thing to not win in the primary, but if she wins the primary and loses, her career is done in the general election. And so it may be a big risk, but we'll see. I don't know that they've decided. I would imagine that.
I would guess she's keeping her options open, but she's at the Munich, on the Munich Security Conference. It's very, very president wanting to, you know, run for president thing to do. So.
Well, also senator.
You know, time will tell. I think that, you know, she's very. The possibilities that could happen just by her policy platform. I'm not even saying that, like, you know. It's not going to be difficult for her as a woman and a woman of color, but I do think that it's going to be quite different if she's running on something like Medicare for All. And Bernie seems to see her as the heir apparent as well.
Matt from PA, MR Crew, some weird tech glitch just happened on YouTube.
I just posted in the YouTube. Just refresh your stream.
Well, obviously you can't hear me say that. Folks were really up in arms about the. Doesn't this happen all the time? Hasn't every halftime show like gotten the right wing upset?
Yes.
Am I imagining that? Every single one.
Well, when they did the Who, I don't think they were mad at that.
No, they weren't mad because there was, but that was all a response to some sort of cultural backlash.
Oh, the Foreigners.
Well, Pete Townsend had some underage scandal, so he was good with them.
Yeah, the Foreigners. Who? The Rolling Stone, they love foreigners.
Oh, white foreigners, right. Okay. Right. I thought you meant like Foreigner, the band.
Well, could have been. But it was after...
You're as cold as ice, man.
It was after the Janet Jackson Nipplegate, another freak out from the right at the time. Then they just had white guys for quite a while. But they've changed course here. I think Jay-Z did some partnership with the NFL.
Which is not unproblematic itself.
Exactly. But putting that aside for a second, they're just like, that was the why Kendrick was the halftime performer last year, which caused the right to freak out. Because God forbid, not everything is for them. And the same thing has happened with Bad Bunny. And the Bad Bunny performance was, like, really amazing and important and needed at the moment. He ended his performance by listing every South American and North American country about, you know, being together and celebrating Latin culture in America and being a part of America as well. So it was really an excellent performance, and it seems like most people feel that way, but not the right.
Incidentally, Cuba is in such crisis right now because of the blockade that we essentially have imposed upon them that Mexico is having to deliver emergency relief, both in terms of like oil and food and whatnot.
They have no jet fuel.
It's a real problem. But here is Let's just give you a sense of some of the tweets that were going on with this halftime show, and then we will take a look at what the alt halftime show was. Let me just say this. Like, it's not a question of, like, the NFL and these TV networks, they don't do charity.
Yeah.
I mean, they may do charity, but not when it comes to the Super Bowl, because it's extremely lucrative. And so they're not, you know, the idea that they're doing anything because they want to make a political point
right.
is absurd. They are trying to maximize profits with every decision they make about the Super Bowl. If NFL was going to give, you know, something for this group or that group or whatever, they should do something for me. Have Yola Tango play.
Yeah.
But they don't do that because it's just not going to be lucrative enough for them to do it. And here is Donald Trump complaining about the halftime show. Now, look.
Do you think he had this written out already and just waited for it to go happen?
100%.
Yeah. They all did. 100%.
Yeah.
The Super Bowl halftime show is absolutely terrible. One of the worst ever. It makes no sense. It's an affront to the greatness of America and doesn't represent our standards of success, creativity, and excellence. Nobody understands a word this guy is saying.
Except people that speak Spanish.
Except for people who speak Spanish. But the imagery, I have to say, like, and I know, Brian, like, Prince, okay, fine, that was fine. But I find, like, the shots of, like, the stage and the little firework, I find it so boring to mm-hmm. me. To look at, like, that type of, like, multi-camera concert footage, I find to be sort of, like, boring. This was the most interesting, from a production standpoint,
yes.
Halftime show, like, we've seen. Like, I would prefer, like, some type of, like, circus stuff. This was the most interesting one I've seen.
What the hell are you talking about?
Can you elaborate on that?
Never. Cirque du Soleil?
Cirque du Soleil, yeah.
Sounded older in your life.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Should have more Cirque du Soleil.
You think he sounded old? I think he sounds like a child.
No, it's like, you know, I want to see interesting stuff.
It all comes together.
Yeah, you're right.
Donald Trump's Super Bowl halftime show stands as a success, creativity, excellence. Nobody understands a word this guy is saying, and the dancing is disgusting. Especially for young children
Which
that
I
are
totally
watching
care about.
From throughout the USA and all over the world. What was the first ad? What was the first like ad or two that was on there? I remember thinking like, oh my God, are they really playing this ad at the beginning?
Trump accounts ad was the first
no,
one
there
remember.
Was another one before that, I feel like. I can't remember what it was. It was for Scream 7.
Oh yeah.
It was like vicious killing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm glad I don't have my 8-year-old, you know, I don't have an 8-year-old kid who's like, wait a second, there's knife stabbing and like, nobody understands a word this guy is saying, and the dancing's disgusting, especially for the young children that are watching from throughout the USA and all over the world.
Well, you want to see some disgusting dancing, just stay tuned.
And incidentally, there are people in the world who probably understand
Spanish.
I would imagine. I don't know.
There's a few of them.
You won the most percentage of voters who might speak Spanish in the history of the Republican Party. I don't know if you remember that, buddy, but it was kind of why you actually won this election.
They're going to ban it.
Might want to remember that.
This quote-unquote show is just a, quote, slap in the face to our country. You know what? He didn't even write this.
No.
There's no way he's like putting... No, he didn't write this. Which is setting new standards. This is Scavino. Setting new standards and records every single day, including the best stock market and 401ks in history.
Oh, wow.
There is nothing inspirational about this mess of a halftime show. And watch, it will get great reviews from the fake news media because they haven't got a clue of what's going on in the real world. And by the way, the NFL should immediately replace its ridiculous new kickoff rule. Make America great again. President Donald J. Trump. That was just thrown in for Scavino to make it sound like it was Trump.
Of course he hates the new kickoff rule. Didn't it reduce injuries? He's like, yeah, down for
more brain damage.
I just do it pretty quickly.
Here's Laura Loomer, who is
even more explicit.
Very offended by what was going on. Illegal aliens and Latin hookers twerking at the Super Bowl. Incidentally, if you are from Puerto Rico, you are an American citizen. Just FYI.
Also,
as opposed to the Rolling Stones or The Who or any of those other British performers we've had.
Irish U2.
Or Irish, yes, U2.
Hookers. Not, you know, background dancers, but because they're Latina, hookers, I guess.
Trump.
Not a single white person or English translation at the Super Bowl. This isn't white enough for me. Well, okay, there you go.
Okay, Laura.
Can't even watch a Super Bowl anymore because immigrants have literally ruined everything. Again.
That immigrant Roger Goodell or whatever.
Yeah, right. Wasn't his dad a Republican senator? But wokeness, it's getting everybody right now.
So many of you probably know this. TPUSA had an alt Super Bowl halftime celebration where I would imagine those 200 people who are actually watching this presently, I don't know if they could watch the Super Bowl because they certainly couldn't have been, you know, maybe they got it on their phone or something. Mm-hmm. They gave up their opportunity. I imagine if you work for TPUSA, you were forced to miss the Super Bowl and watch so that you could watch this. But so some dude, old dude, how old is Kid Rock now?
Oh, he's in his 50s.
Well, nothing That's wrong it. With that. But I'll say, as a guy in his 50s, we don't exactly have the pulse of the nation, culturally speaking.
Well, isn't that what TPUSA is supposed to be about? I thought it's about getting the kids, the youth,
the kids love
to vote Republican. That was the whole thing. That's the whole mission of this group.
This looks like somebody who doesn't apply to the kids.
What if we did something? What if we had a Burt Bacharach? We could get to do the halftime.
Ooh, the kids love a fedora.
And you know what? People usually like the Super Bowl because of the production value and the spectacle of people coming out to do this big show for hundreds of millions of people. But that's pretentious, honestly. Yeah. Don't you want Kid Rock stripped down? Sorry to give that image for people in people's minds.
Jean shorts.
I mean musically. Stripped down to just his voice and the microphone and some jean shorts, just talent right in front of you. Oh, wait, was his microphone even on?
Well, here's the thing is that I'm old enough to remember when Milli Vanilli really were basically drummed out of the show business.
Or Jessica Simpson's sister?
Yes, Ashley Simpson. She.
This is kind of the dance that Simpson was doing, too.
Exactly. On SNL, the track started playing before she was ready, and it became apparent that she was lip syncing. And it feels like Kid Rock kind of.
Now,
must have watched that.
Who was it that made the claim that this was just a question of the audio? Was it Posobiec?
Posobiec questioned because he was totally singing in person. It must be a stream issue.
Here is you can decide whether this was a stream issue or not, but there are times when what's interesting is that like. It feels like Kid Rock just basically, like, maybe he just got caught up in the moment. Who knows what was going on? But for whatever reason, it wasn't that his lips and the music were out of sync. It's that he didn't even bring the microphone up to his face when he was supposedly singing.
It was Charlie.
People can make this.
It was Charlie was amplifying his voice.
Charlie magic. And this is for the questions that don't have any answers.
I mean,
oh my God!
They're even trying to get around it with the lack of, with the cutting.
Can you slow it down? Can you slow it down a little bit? And maybe we can see if there's actually like even any breaks where you would put the microphone down.
Yes, right.
Like he's like an
old man.
Go back even further.
Look at this old man.
Like, go back a little, like 8 seconds, and then that's where it gets worse. Yeah, here we go.
Someone looking for you?
Look at those shorts.
Yeah, go back. Yeah, go.
Why is he doing Warrior 2?
That's the outfit.
There's no breaks that's long enough to justify that microphone.
Also, the line "chicks with beepers" must really resonate with the young kids.
Oh yeah,
chicks with beepers.
I love those chicks with
beepers. Do people under the age of like 30 even know what a beeper is?
I barely knew what a beeper was. Like, that was like old technology by the time I was.
I mean, he has other lyrics. I'm surprised he didn't sing the song where he talked about his song Cool Daddy Cool. One of the lyrics is, young ladies, I like them underage. Some say that's statutory. I say it's mandatory. He didn't want to include that for the wholesome TV USA presentation.
Weird headliner.
I'm pretty sure that song was for Osmosis Jones, too. I'm 99% sure.
Oh, really?
Like, that's what he made that song for.
It got a little bit classy right after this, though. There was a little break. Well, he did a costume change because that was a great costume. The jean shorts and fedora.
I know. That's what I'm saying. The spectacle.
And it looks like he was running late and he just had to run on stage.
And people can go back and check this, but he was introduced by some black guys that called him his homie when he came out as Kid Rock. And then the same guys introduced him later and called him their friend when he came out as Robert Ritchie, the country singer, which was a little bit of an interesting little stylistic choice. But here's the intermission here. And, I don't think anything was plugged in the entire night as far as music instruments were concerned.
Except the iPod. The kids are just...
This is when I... And there's the pirate guy.
Is this Hamilton? Yeah, damn.
Beautiful stuff.
That's
the real America.
This is who came out after Ba with the Ba. To give Kid Rock, a.k.a. Robert Ritchie, enough time to go back and change costumes so he could come out as his country persona. And they're not playing their instruments well either. Like, their fingers don't really correspond to the notes they're playing. This went on for a long time.
Can you imagine... If they did, those two people were playing at the real Super Bowl.
Why won't they represent real Americans like this pirate guy? And then, yeah, and then here's the guys introducing Kid Rock again when he comes back out after the pirate.
Bad Bunny was on stage the whole time except for Gaga. Love seeing my girl out there doing a little bit of a musical interlude. Like, why does Kid Rock need to go backstage at all? There's no production value.
He took his jean shorts off and his fedora because
he
came back.
He has two identities.
So
he's the rapper, and then he identifies as a country singer.
Okay.
Yeah, and you should respect both.
Has he always been a country singer, too? Or is he trying to,
like 20 years.
Rebrand, or what?
Yeah, when he went MAGA or whatever, he's kind of been just doing country.
Okay.
So here he is coming out as this country persona after that little intermission with the pirate guy playing the cello.
Please welcome our brother, Robert Ritchie.
Brother, yeah. Electric.
How did he do that? How did he switch from Kid Rock to Robert Ritchie?
And he's wearing a different hat now, a less hip-hop hat from the fedora he was wearing before.
Trucker hat, so you know what's up.
You can always put a rain check in his hand.
You know, just put a rain check in his hand. Go Google the house that Robert Ritchie grew up in Michigan. It is massive. His dad was, I believe, a major car dealer. So this whole country folk, we just like, give me a rain check
in
my hand.
Was it southern Michigan that he was from, or whereabouts?
I'm pretty sure like Lansing, East Lansing, maybe.
South of Detroit.
Here's this old southern boy.
Till you can't. You can't. Till you can't. You can keep putting on forever with that girl whose heart you hold.
Why did the stream work during this performance and not the other one?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
He doesn't have to dance here, so he can lip sync.
Yeah, he doesn't lose his breath. He's probably
gasping.
That's
really right.
I highly doubt he's singing live here either. Come on.
Yeah,
it's just a slow song.
It's just able to sync up a little bit better.
Yeah.
put the microphone from my mouth the whole time. Yeah. So that way I could always like, you don't have to lift it up at the times where there's song, music, yeah, singing happening.
Let's skip 4 minutes ahead.
Give your life to Jesus and he'll give you a second chance till you can't.
It seems like his first chance went better than his second chance went. The Robert Ritchie? Okay. Sure, buddy. Oh yeah, here's the house, by the way. I just want to put it up. Kid Rock's childhood home from atasteofcountry.com. Here we go. There we go.
Aww.
It has its own tennis court, so
you need room for Jesus to show up there.
I mean, Jesus
could land his helicopter right in the back there.
He loves a fedora, doesn't he?
Oh yeah. As all real men do.
Masculinity. That's what I'm saying. That's enough of that. Bring back the cellist. I'm bored.
Yeah, right?
Exactly. Where's the pirate? Is he boarding some ship right now?
Jack Posobiec kicked it off with going, Charlie, this is for you.
Oh, did he?
Yes.
Do you want to do 17 on the Waymo thing? Or something else?
I don't know. I like this these US Olympiads,
sure,
because you got to feel a little bad for some of these people in the Olympics. They come, they're representing this country,
yeah,
and they're embarrassed by the country. They're embarrassed by it.
We were, the United States and Israel booed to high heavens.
I feel heartbroken.
Booed to high heavens at the opening ceremonies.
Good. Thank
which
you, world.
They, I mean, I was anticipating Israel for sure, of course. We deserve it.
Absolutely.
We deserve it. This is what we look like on the national stage. And I remember, like, we would, that's how a lot of people felt about our illegal invasion of Iraq and how embarrassing George W. Bush was on the national stage, but we are in an even worse situation now.
Yes, compounded by the fact that it's happening again. Like, there's no course correction.
No, it just gets worse.
So, but got a feel for these athletes who, and good for them for articulating it because, of course, you know, Donald Trump has already targeted these folks. Let's start with Amber Glenn. She is a U.S. figure skater.
Yeah, it's been a hard time for the community overall under this administration. It isn't the first time that we've had to come together.
She's queer, so when she says community, she's talking about the LGBTQ community.
It's been a hard time for the community overall under this administration. It isn't the first time that we've had to come together as a community and try and fight for our human rights. And now, especially, it's not just affecting the queer community, but many other communities. And I think that we are able to support each other in a way that we didn't have to before, and because of that, it's made us a lot stronger. I hope I can use my platform and my voice throughout these games to try and encourage people to stay strong in these hard times. I know that a lot of people say, you're just an athlete, like, stick to your job, shut up about politics, but politics affect us all. It is something that I will not just be quiet about because it is something that affects us in our everyday lives. So, of course, there are things that I disagree with, but as a community, we are strong and we support each other, and brighter days are ahead of us.
I mean, it has always been fascinating as to, like, why athletes or actors who have platforms because of the nature of our society are told you can't speak about politics. But if you, I don't know, were a early investor in, let's say, PayPal and make a ton of money, it's just taken for granted that, of course, you should not only have an opinion about politics, but should fundamentally alter their trajectory.
Yeah, and the nature of the Olympics means they have to wear the American flag on their uniform, and they're supposedly representing the country. They actually have to, if this conflicts with their conscience, speak out about this, because they don't want to be associated with this country brutalizing immigrants and people on the streets and secret police rounding people up into concentration camps. So sports have always been places for obviously political protests, including the Olympics in 1968, with one of the more famous acts of protests in like the past 100 or so years, with the Black Power salute.
Or Max Schmeling, you know the story of Max Schmeling? He was a German. Hitler, his favorite boxer, sent him to fight Joe Louis. He beat Joe Louis, became a hero for Nazi Germany. Turns out he was hiding Jews in his hotel room, was an anti-Nazi, was shunned by all of Germany, ended up friends with Joe Louis for years. Huh. Yeah.
But I didn't even know that one.
Here is the USA freestyle skiers, Chris Lillis and Hunter Hess.
I feel heartbroken about what's happened in the United States I'm pretty sure you're referencing ICE and some of the protests and things like that. I think that as a country, we need to focus on respecting everybody's rights and making sure that we're treating our citizens as well as anybody with love and respect. And I hope that when people look at athletes compete in the Olympics, they realize that that's the America that we're trying to represent.
It brings up mixed emotions to represent the U.S. right now, I think. It's a little hard. There's obviously a lot going on that I'm not the biggest fan of, and I think a lot of people aren't. If it aligns with my moral values, I feel like I'm representing it. Just because I'm wearing the flag doesn't mean I represent everything that's going on in the U.S. I just kind of want to do it for my friends and my family and the people that support me getting here.
I feel...
Yeah, for your friends and family. How can you do that? I mean, if I were in their position, I would be saying the exact same thing.
It's a little telling that you have people going over there and can't have national pride.
Doing this for my family and stuff, not the country.
That would be my. And think about
this. That's how you should do it.
These athletes in things like skiing and figure skating, I mean, those are even more high profile than the other more specialized sports where you work to go to the Olympics every 4 years for this a specific sport. They're not very well compensated. It's difficult for them to make money in this area. And so you get to the pinnacle of your career and you're also supposed to be wrapped up in this sort of patriotic representation of your country, and your country is betraying your values. It takes guts to say these kinds of things because there's money on the line.
All right, let's read some IMs and then we will wrap things up. We'll take some phone calls tomorrow, folks. LXH Pinky. There is such grand network in Minneapolis, St. Paul that whenever ICE wipes show up for gas or food or anything, they quickly shoot away without their gas or food or whatever. It's so awesome. 50 arrested outside the Whipple building for throwing objects. The objects were dildos. Hundreds of them donated by a local sex shop in Minneapolis. That's fantastic.
Heroes free them all.
Deborah all off it tall. Sam, please feel free to suck on a bloody sock while you tell us how awesome New England sports used to be. F. Tom Brady, Curt Schilling, and Larry Bird. What did Larry Bird do?
Leave Larry Bird out of this.
Yes, let's come on.
What are you talking about? What did he do?
Bird's a good guy.
Stood by Magic Johnson when everybody else was being homophobic.
Yep. True. Carolina Jeff, I don't know y'all like messages in the first half, but I won't be around for the fun half. Just wanted to say, in the humble opinion of someone swore an oath to defend the Constitution, any attempt to interfere with Congress's ability to subpoena a president for criminal behavior or otherwise interfere with congressional oversight powers should be considered treasonous behavior, full stop. Keep doing good work, y'all. Iowa Ryan. Carrie Lake moved to Davenport, Iowa, looking to run for something. Iowa is starting to turn things around. I don't think she'll find much success here.
I mean, if I was anything like North Dakota, like moving to a state like that and expecting to be their representative in any office, like people really resent that more than they resent actual politics.
The Mill Rind. South of Detroit is Canada. Kid Rock singing.
Windsor.
Really?
Kid Rock singing about Jesus. It's like Eric Cartman forming the band Faith Plus One. People's eyebrow. There's a certain irony in this interview following Sam's ad read for Factor. I mean, indeed. Absolutely. J.D. Pants. In the 1985 Super Bowl, had Up With People mired in scandal. Had Up With People mired in scandal. Noah from Tampa. Where can you even do winter sports in Israel?
That's a good point.
Skiing down the Golan Heights.
The Jamaican bobsled team.
Yeah.
The thing he actually did post on Truth Social did contain what he described. This is by my Kyle. It was a screen recording of a dramatic video about voting fraud. And at the end screened recording, it showed Obama as a gorillas. He didn't actually post the full Lion King video that the slop generator made.
So the plausibility and deniability wasn't in the actual thing he saw at all. That it could have been something about the Lion King. It was just the racist thing about them as monkeys, including some bullshit propaganda about voting. Okay.
Stephen Miller's hairline. The halftime show was great, although wasn't quite as good as Charlie Kirk's funeral. Needed more pyrotechnics. I mean, the show they put on for the memorial thing had a lot of like pyrotechnics.
It did, yes.
They may have used the budget.
It's like a Rammstein.
Right. Show. So many indoor pyrotechnics, too. I just, that always scares the crap out of me.
Yeah, I'm not going to be, I don't need to be at any place. I've heard too many stories.
I mean, I'm a very anti-fireworks person. Maybe that's my least American thing, but enough of those, the fireworks. They're mean to dogs. We don't need it.
The veteran in me is very offended.
There you go. No,
I'm against you.
Dang it.
I love fireworks.
I thought you had like a Born on the 4th of July style like
version. No, I was in Georgia for this whole time.
Vox did like the target practice.
No, we just like explosions.
Vox Populi. I have a hard time believing these triple Trumpers had such a quick change of heart. All right, three more.
It's the economy that makes them look back. It's like if the economy was roaring right now,
yep.
A lot of this sort of moralizing wouldn't happen.
Exactly.
Skid Mark Twain, I tuned in for the Kid Rock halftime show. It was just a bad show, regardless of music or politics. It wasn't lied, nor was it shot on HD. I had to watch this heaping pile of crap in 480. This is like when Dylan went electric. Sim One, shout out to the local Immigrant Rights Alliance. I've recently joined. The leaders are all immigrants of color, and they led a march of over 2,000 on Saturday. I'm really impressed with their bravery, especially in the red area that we live. And the final I am of the day. Queef Latino. Wait, Obama was deporting people and having an open border? Question mark.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, it's almost like they can't actually think through a principle or a fact.
Matt, Brian, Emma, great job today, folks. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks.
Shifted it.